Welcome to F1 Debrief. They 404'd their driver. Coming up this week, we discuss forgetting how to drive, why cake isn't always bad luck, and karting cowboys.
We have a gloriously sunny day here in the studio. We've seen some action this morning as well. Jessica Ennis, good night.
Good week, bad week.
It's been a bad week for Channel 4 as they had to replace the host of their athletics championships because he couldn't get the names of the people right and he really just seemed to struggle with the occasion all round. It doesn't relate to F1 specifically except that it is slightly worrying who they might have chosen to present F1 if they'd won that bid. And also, they managed to find someone worse than EJ.
Oh my goodness me. The similarities are uncanny. Channel 4 took the athletics off of the BBC. Which is exactly what they wanted to do with F1, and they put in a rookie presenter, untested and completely out of his depth. I do hope that anybody who wished Channel 4 would have got the F1 coverage has a chance to look at the showreel of what Channel 4, the kind of programs that Channel 4 make. I think we had a lucky escape with F1 going to Sky.
It's been a good week for Robert Kubica, who had a final surgery on his elbow that went very well. The elbow was causing a bit of a hold-up in his recovery progress due to lack of movement, so they decided to operate and free it up. The surgeon said it was successful, so a couple of days in hospital and he'll be back training again.
He'll be back training? That's good, but is that just arm training as opposed to F1 training, right?
Whatever kind of recovery comes after such a big accident.
Yes, and then once he's okay with that, then he goes on to do the car training and the Formula 1 training.
If you say so.
It's a long way away.
It's been a bad week for Richard Branson as his holiday home on an island in the Caribbean burnt down. There were 20 people who escaped from the fire, including Kate Winslet, who apparently saved Richard Branson's mother. Everyone was safe, thankfully, although he did admit that he jumped out of bed and ran outside naked straight into a cactus bush. Ouch.
Ow, ow, ow. Poor Richard. It doesn't rain, it pours. I mean, his car, his team's right at the back of the grid, and then his house burns down. When will it get better for the guy?
It's been a good week for Jenson Button fans as the McLaren driver confirmed he'll be at the Race of Champions this year. McLaren aren't usually so fond of letting their drivers participate in non-McLaren extracurricular activities, so this is unusual. Meanwhile, Heikki Kovalainen keeps on reiterating that he won't be there this year after damaging his girlfriend last time.
Oh my goodness, for how many years have we decried McLaren for not letting their drivers race in the Race of Champions? And the year after Heikki Kovalainen has a pretty serious accident and justifies McLaren's decision, do they suddenly go and let one of their drivers race? Do you think they don't like Jensen that much?
News and views.
There's been a little bit of news since we last spoke. Most of it has revolved around Nick Heidfeld. First, he was kicked out of Renault. Then he said he was coming back to Renault. He was going to take them to court and he had a valid contract. And now it's fine. They've split. It's all settled.
The thing I like about this dispute between Nick Heidfeld and Renault is that it was over so quickly. One minute he's out of the team, and the next minute he's suing the team, and then finally it's all over and done with. In the blink of an eye, I wish all Formula One disputes were over that quickly. We're going to court, we're not going to court, we're happy, we love each other, bye.
It was another example of something being very, very mishandled by the team.
A PR disaster. No question about it. Firstly, Eddie Jordan got the scoop, and it was maybe 5 days ahead of the announcement from Renault that Eddie Jordan first mentioned it.
Well, it came, the BBC posted it saying, Senna in, Heidfeld out, says Eddie Jordan, and everyone's like, yeah, right.
Well, the last time Eddie Jordan, what was his last scoop? The Michael Schumacher coming back to Formula One, he was right about that.
Always the bearer of bad news, that chap.
He is. But the problem is that the Renault PR department fluffed it. They dropped the ball. There was a point prior to the Grand Prix when Nick Heidfeld was unceremoniously removed from their website.
Yeah.
It was picked up. I forget who picked it up. It was picked up on Twitter. It was like, you look for Nick Heidfeld on the website and you get a 404 page not found. They 404'd their driver.
That's
publicly.
Quite rude.
Before they announced what was going on.
Because in the end, he came back, but he'd been moved down the order to like third driver or something.
They reshuffled. We should check now. They reshuffled the order. It was Nick Heidfeld was in prime position on the Renault website. And then within 2 days, he was gone. And then he was returned in position 3.
Yeah.
And then finally, I guess he's gone now. I don't know. I don't even care now. It's just, again, so much. There were so many chances to handle the situation well, and in every instance, Renault screwed it up.
Yeah. Now it's all settled. Heidfeld said, "Thanks to the team and all the friends I made there. I wish them good luck in everything. Here's to the future." And Beaulieu said, "We thank him for his contribution." So it's all nice and friendly now. But before it was settled, when they were all going to court, Eric Beaulieu really spoke out
What about did he say?
Heidfeld, and he said, Nick is a nice guy, but I think something did not work. His leadership didn't work in the team. And when you are sometimes slower than Vitaly, in fact, most of the time slower than Vitaly, it's difficult for him to push the team and to settle himself as the team leader.
Which is not true, because Nick Heidfeld had more points than Vitaly. If Bullier's argument is Nick Heidfeld wasn't Robert Kubica, and they expected Robert Kubica, the guy has no argument because nobody, I mean, we didn't think that Nick Heidfeld could be another Robert Kubica. Nothing in Nick's career has ever suggested that he was going to be a great team leader. Nothing in his career has ever suggested that he was going to set the world on fire, despite Renault's attempts to set him on fire. And from my point of view, I don't understand what happened to Renault in the sense that everything that happened with Nick Heidfeld was expected to happen by us. So why didn't they see it coming?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised that he was as slow as he was. I'm not surprised that he wasn't a team leader. We knew all this before they signed him. So how can you stand up and go, actually, a bit of a surprise, he's a bit slow, he wasn't a very good team leader. You know, I wanted him to be Fernando Alonso and he wasn't. Well, we know he wasn't.
But then they've brought in Bruno Senna, who is brand new. He's not going to be a team leader either.
Nobody has more money than Nick Heidfeld.
Yeah, compared to Senna, Petrov is far more of a team leader because he's been there for a year already.
Yes, it's not a strong lineup. We will talk about Bruno Senna's debut, I guess, when we get to the race discussion. The problem Renault have now is if Robert Kubica doesn't come back for next year, that's likely the lineup they've got for the foreseeable future.
Or with Grosjean, perhaps, but he has no experience either, really.
Again, there's not a strong team leader there. They don't have one, and they haven't replaced Nick Heidfeld with a strong team leader, partly because there aren't that many on the market right now.
Talking of contracts and things, Mark Webber has re-signed at Red Bull for 2012. One more year on his career.
Every single year, it's a year contract for Mark Webber.
Yeah.
Every time. Never going to give him more than that. It's just spoon-feeding him contracts. Year on year, here you go, Mark, have another one. Another 12 months.
I can't imagine why he would want to sign with
why
them.
Why would
really?
You put yourself... I'll tell you why, because Adrian Newey is a genius and everybody wants to drive his cars. And is Vettel taking part in the Race of Champions this year? Maybe Webber is hoping he'll do a Kovalainen and he'll injure himself and then Webber might have a better chance next year. Although, I guess likely, Mark Webber is the man to injure himself in the off-season.
I was going
to
say, given previous form.
That can be his only reason. He must be hoping that Vettel will go off the boil and he has a chance next year. It's a biased team. It's a slanted team. I don't know why he'd put himself through it. Maybe he believes it isn't anymore, but or maybe he believes he has no other chance elsewhere.
Red Bull are definitely doing the right thing by the fans, if not the drivers, because they did the whole Austin thing where they drove around with cowboys on horseback. And this week they went to Cardiff and drove around with cowboys in carts.
That's harsh. Rookies in carts. Young boys in carts.
Yeah, but the winner of they went there for the grand final of the karting speed jam thing. And the winner, overall winner, best driver there, he lost places at the start, he span round, he crashed into barriers, and still won the whole thing.
It was a good drive, I'm sure. We have a guest post from several attendees on Side Podcast. We'll put a link in the show notes. It's well worth a read. It looks like Red Bull did a fine job of representing the sport. Cardiff is an unusual choice, but I think it worked out very well. It was a ticket-only event, and we found out a bit too late, so we couldn't go. We are drinking cans of Red Bull now with Speed Jam codes on it, so we could have gone had we drunk this Red Bull faster. We failed. In that aspect. But, you know, good on Red Bull. It sounded like it went well. The
race. Everything about the Belgian Grand Prix weekend was sort of interlinked. So we're not doing qualifying separately because it was like two-day stories.
Now, you'd expect that normally of a race weekend, but usually what happens is what happens in qualifying stays in qualifying, and then the race goes about its business regardless of what happened in qualifying. Whereas this time, they were very much inseparable.
Yeah. I am going to talk about qualifying first, though, because what is the point of the 107% rule.
Does that make you mad?
It made me so angry.
I love that it appears on screen as if anybody cares, as if it makes any difference at all, because whoever falls outside the 107% rule always gets let back in. I think with the exception of the two HRTs in the first Grand Prix, it's never had any bearing at all on anything in this season. What a waste of time.
So this week, there was Michael Schumacher who crashed, so he didn't set a time in qualifying. He fell outside the 107%
rule.
Fair
enough. If he didn't get a chance to run, I'm okay with that one.
Two HRT cars and one Virgin car. Now,
slow.
I understand that people would want Jerome D'Ambrosio to run in his home Grand Prix. That would make sense. I quite like him. I'd want him
to run
that.
Would have been a harsh decision to throw him out.
Not if he's not fast enough. What is the point of this rule? And people have said to me that it's an exception because of the rain. You know, that's happened before. But the actual rule in the regulations. It says, under exceptional circumstances, however, which may include setting a suitable lap time in a free practice session, the stewards may permit the car to start the race. Now, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure rain is not exceptional at Spa.
It's the norm.
If they're not fast enough, they shouldn't be allowed to race or take the rule away.
You know, I think the problem isn't the rule. I think the problem is Virgin and HRT. Here is the thing. Both teams have decided to no longer develop their car for the rest of this year, partly because they haven't got any money and partly because their cars are so bad it's pointless throwing more money at it. And therefore, they are running the risk of being outside the 107% rule and then being allowed back in. They're walking a very thin line knowing that they will get let back in.
Yeah, it's not really a risk because they know that it's going to be fine.
But it's their fault for not developing their car. Now, Virgin have decided this week, they've decided that they will bring a new package to Monza. I suspect because they know Jerome is, with the current car, Jerome is not going to make that 107% race after race after race. And they've made an emergency decision to do something about it. They had decided, you know, that no more development, no more cost, no more expense on his car. It's just, it's fallen behind so rapidly. Predictably, I think we did call this when they shelved developments for the rest of this year, they're going to have to rush something in. I don't know what the HRT boys are going to do because they haven't got the money to do anything about it. So they're running this risk, and it's making
them... It's not a risk.
Well, it's a slight risk because it may not get allowed through, but obviously they always are at the moment. I mean, if it happens race after race after race, there may come a point when they're not.
But they're always going to be allowed in because then at this point, if they go a couple of races where they have been allowed in and then suddenly the FIA decide, no, actually, we're going to stop that.
Right.
Well, then they're becoming inconsistent, which obviously does sound like the FIA.
Yes.
But would make them look more of a laughingstock than they already do.
So now you think they've overridden this 107% rule so many times that it's now pointless anyway.
It really is.
Yeah, it just takes up screen space in qualifying. That's it.
As it turns out, the race was kind of exceptional because there wasn't any rain for the actual race itself. There was plenty of rain in the previous few days in free practice and qualifying, but for those 2 hours, it was dry.
It was dry and it was nice, and I was glad to see that. I did not need more variables thrown in that race.
No. However, the lack of damp circuit kind of made some of the teams worried about their tyres, and a big tyre issue sprang up before the race.
Dangerous! Warning! Hazard! Those kind of
big neon
concerns.
Signs.
Yes. Over-dramatisation is probably the best way of selling it. Camber, I think, explains everything in this situation.
So really, was it just Red Bull? I heard reports that it might have been McLaren as well, I'm not sure. But Red Bull have been doing the camber of their wheels over what Pirelli recommend,
yes,
outside of the boundaries, and that meant that their tyres could possibly be dangerous in the race, but it's their own fault.
So I think the problem here was it rained on Friday, and it rained on Saturday, and the teams didn't get chance to run their car at full tilt, and they didn't, you know, they didn't expect the wear that they got. And then, because of the risk of rain, they ran the cars longer than they normally would in qualifying. We've seen Red Bull just do that one flying lap, and then sit in the garage for the remaining 5 minutes. We've decried that over and over again throughout the season. But in Spa, because the track kept getting quicker and quicker, you just had to be out there until the very last, and you had to keep running the cars. And it looks like the Red Bulls can't handle that. The way they set up their car for qualifying, it simply the tyres cannot handle what they were giving it. Pirelli say they're over this limit, and they've suggested narrower specifications for the remaining Grand Prix because of this problem. We have mentioned, I think, maybe not on the podcast, but certainly in the comments, if you look at the Red Bull, the front wheels look like the roof of your house. The tyres, you know, it's like an inverted
triangular.
V. Yeah, the front tyres are an inverted V. They definitely run more camber than the rest of the teams, and that's presumably how they're getting their speed, and that calls their tyres to wear, essentially to damage the makeup of the tyre.
Yeah, Adrian Newey said he was very concerned, and Pirelli actually came to the team after qualifying and said they were concerned about the damage that appeared to have been sustained on the tyres, and they thought that a structural failure could be imminent, which sounds very reminiscent of the US Grand Prix,
mm-hmm,
that debacle.
Same, similar problem, yep.
So there was lots of debate going on, and we saw footage of Vettel being right up in a Pirelli man's face and having quite
he
a heated discussion. It didn't look like he was shouting, but he certainly wasn't happy. And so Pirelli said they suggested higher tyre pressures or reduce the camber, and Red Bull didn't want to do either of those things because the cars were in park ferme, mm-hmm, and it would mean starting from the back. Also, the FIA weren't willing to consider the tyres damaged.
Rightly so.
So they had to start on the ones they'd qualified on. And Adrian Newey said that It was one of the scariest races I've ever been involved in. Heart in mouth stuff, because first and foremost, our duty of care is to the driver's safety.
Is it?
Lies.
It's not, though, is it? Because if his duty of care was to the drivers, they would have parked them. They would have brought them into the pits and changed the tyres.
Yeah, they did pit really quite early. Third lap, fifth lap, something like that.
Webber pitted on lap four.
But if he was so worried, he would have made that call to start them from the back of the grid. It's not like they don't have enough of a gap at the front of the championship that they could lose one race.
I suspect that Red Bull did their best to make a fuss to get... They saw a chance to get some free tyres. And having not won a race for a while, they wanted to make as much fuss as they could. And after causing so much fuss and being denied and actually not having any problems in the race, I think they got to the end of the race and were a bit embarrassed about what they'd done, and then decided to build it up a bit more and try and justify their own actions.
But it makes me think less of Adrian Newey, because driver safety is really important and it should be your first and foremost concern, but clearly it wasn't, so don't lie about it.
Yes. Well, I think after the race, he was over-exaggerating how bad the situation was. That's what it is. I mean, they put a camera in his face. The BBC put a camera in his face, and he realised, actually, that the question is, you said the tyres were going to be dangerous, and nothing happened, and you went on to win the race. What do you make of this, Adrian? Well, I was really scared, is what he said, because, you know, what anything else is going to make him look like a drama queen?
That made him look like a drama queen. But Paul Hembree of Pirelli fame, he said, what we had hoped here, if somebody was in difficulty, that they would have run the race on the prime tyre that would have run without any issues whatsoever. However, everybody went for performance, and that was disappointing.
Oh, bless Paul, he's so naive.
Yeah.
Everybody went for performance. What?
Imagine
that. Did he really, really expect that a Formula One team would take the slower but safer option? Really?
The start of the race then, Bruno Senna failed in spectacular fashion. He forgot there was a corner.
Can we talk about his qualifying?
Yeah.
We should do that first. Before we damn the guy, you know, before we slate his talent and his ability, let's first reflect on what he did do, which was he stepped into a team and a car that he doesn't have much experience on. He did do a demo run at Spa previously.
Yeah,
in the
I think he did a Friday session as well.
Oh, yeah, of course he did. Yes, in Hungary.
Yeah, but not
in anticipation of this. He hasn't had a lot of time in that car. In all of the qualifying, he crashed in the first Friday practice one, was it? He spun. I saw him spinning backwards into the barriers on some highlights. I think it must have been free practice one. After that point, he did very well on Friday. He did great on Saturday, and he out-qualified his more experienced teammate on the first go.
Yeah, that's
slightly incredible.
Embarrassing.
On Saturday, I was so very, very, very impressed with Bruno Senna. Really good showing.
Everyone said it was looking like he was going to be brilliant, and, you know, it really did seem that he was just going to have a handle on the car and do really well. But then, come race day, on the formation lap, the people were on his radio telling him to remember how to brake and remember what he had to do this, and then he shot away from the line and forgot to brake.
Yes, and
forgot to turn into a corner.
In the process, wrecked Jaime Altuzarra's best ever qualifying position.
Gutted.
Over at the first corner, really quite annoyed. So all of that work undone within several hundred metres. And that was it. It was just over.
Yeah, it was really impressive in qualifying, because it was like, oh, Senna's up there. Oh, Altuzarra's up there. This is amazing. People are all mixed up and out of place. And how cool is this? And both of them were completely ruined in that first corner.
Yes,
and
they
were. All Senna's fault.
So you're not a big Senna fan after his Renault debut.
He has time to make it up to me. But firstly, he out-qualified Petrov, so that's no good.
Mm.
And then he messed up Altuzarra's race, which is doubly no good.
The thing is, we have to give the guy much more time in order to evaluate what he can and can't do. I think the changeable conditions played into his hands, because none of the drivers were really on it, you know, full on it in qualifying. They had a bit in hand because of the conditions, and I think that gave him a chance to shine.
Yeah, my only real complaint is that talking to the BBC afterwards, he said, perhaps I should have taken it a bit more carefully, seeing as it was my first race.
Perhaps.
Yes, perhaps you should have.
I don't know if he went to apologise to Jaime afterwards, but he certainly should have. It was all his fault. Too eager, didn't understand the car with that much fuel on board, which is the team's fault for not giving him that much fuel in practice to learn it. And you know, let's see what he does next race.
Yeah. Talking of drivers out of position, as we mentioned, Schumacher crashed out in qualifying, so he didn't set a time at all, started from the back of the grid, did pretty impressive job to finish fifth.
Do you know what? If we had recorded this podcast last Sunday, e.g. the immediately after the race had finished,
which was the plan, but
our plans, it was a side podcast plan, I would have almost certainly given Michael Schumacher driver of the day, because that was an impressive drive. However,
are we not doing that? Should I cross him up?
No.
Oh,
after
dear.
Not for me anyway. I don't know if you've seen the footage, but on Monday some onboard footage came to light where Michael Schumacher, in the opening laps, he did well at the first corner. He made up a lot of places. He kept his nose clean as everyone else was crashing out. He passed, I think, one HRT under waved yellow flags, which he should have got a penalty for, but didn't. Then he passed, he jumped the chicane and passed Paul Resta, and so gained another place illegally and didn't give that place back. And therefore, although he did well to come from where he was to where he got to, it wasn't a clean drive and it wasn't an honest drive. And I'm amazed Paul Resta didn't complain and say, by the way, Michael Schumacher just nicked a place off me.
Do any of those incidents fall under the thing where the stewards don't look at what happens on the first corner because it's too much?
No.
That happened before, didn't it?
It was on the... I can understand that we may have discussed that in the past, I think, but this, yeah, was definitely on the run down to Eau Rouge and then on the following straight, I think. The chicane that follows that. So it was a good drive, but it wasn't... I mean, that was... I've only seen the opening lap up close, and already there was two illegal moves in that opening two laps.
I'm going to need to put my thinking cap on then.
Can give him driver of the day. You know, maybe... I mean, there is a debate that he hadn't made the pass before he jumped the chicane, and it was the steward's fault they missed the wave jello is not his.
Other drivers out of place, Jenson Button and Paul de Resta, both of whom were screwed over by their teams in qualifying. Button screwed over by McLaren? What are the chances?
Never! Oh my goodness me. Yeah, Jensen, you could see on the McLaren live ticker, Jensen was on the radio saying, tell me what the positions are, tell me what the positions are, I'm still racing. And all the responses coming back at him from McLaren were, it's over, you're fine, you've got loads of time, plenty of time in hand, come back in, Jensen, it's all sweetness and light. Oh, you're out of qualifying.
Yeah, in both instances, McLaren and Force India called their drivers in, said, it's fine, you're through. Mm. And because the conditions were, it was a damp track drying and getting quicker all the time.
Yep.
The times just dropped and they were dropped out of qualifying.
I can see exactly what happened. In both instances, the teams were concentrating on their other drivers. They were focusing on Suto, they were focusing on getting Lewis Hamilton through, and they just forgot the second drivers.
I'd be really mad if that was me.
Yes. Let's talk about Lewis Hamilton. Whilst we're on the McLaren thing, we should talk about this. What's your thoughts? We've had we did a Side with Joe podcast. We've heard Joe's thoughts. I want to know what your thoughts are.
On which bit in particular?
Well,
you know, my first thought is, why is it always Lewis Hamilton?
Every single podcast, every single race, he's always the guy we're talking about. I don't care whether this was his fault. I don't care whether this was someone else's fault. I would like to know why it's always Lewis Hamilton.
Yeah.
When was the last time we discussed Nico Rosberg and the incidents he's got into during any podcast?
Those things that Nico Rosberg said to the stewards and things like that. Terrible.
Why is Lewis Hamilton so damn controversial? It doesn't matter if he was always right. How is he always in the mix? I don't understand it.
So there was the thing with Hamilton versus Maldonado.
Okay, so your take is?
My take is that Maldonado was clearly very much in the wrong, and it looked like a deliberate move. Although everything he said afterwards is like, no, and if anyone approaches him about that, he seems stunned by that idea that it would be a deliberate thing,
yes,
even though that's what it clearly looked like. But the stewards also gave Hamilton a reprimand,
yep,
for that incident. And I just think perhaps there's something that we didn't see.
We didn't see anything. That's the problem.
We spoke to Joe, as you said, and he pointed out that there may be something along the lines of Hamilton is so wary of talking to the stewards, trying not to say anything wrong, that it sounds like he's trying to hide something, and that might be where that comes from.
It could be. My annoyance with this whole situation is there wasn't a decent camera angle. There was one camera in the arm cone that was filthy. There was a long lens camera miles away that barely picked up anything. We didn't see any onboard telemetry. We've seen no decent onboard cameras. There was one of Lewis, but it started too late, and there was nothing from the onboard camera of Pastor Maldonado. It's just the most annoying thing about that incident is there's no way we can call it either way. There's no way no fans, as far as I know, watching the coverage from their sofa, has seen enough of that incident to call it, because nothing was filmed. They just missed it all. It's terrible.
The earliest bit of footage we've got, Hamilton's already waving in the air, mm-hmm, as though something has happened and we don't know what that is.
A very, very long lens shot of Lewis jinking to the right and jinking to the left, but the cars are just a blur in the distance. It's terrible. So in the end, I don't have an opinion either way, because I have to defer to whatever the stewards decided, because they have way more information than us on this one. We just have nothing to go on.
we did see plenty of Hamilton versus Kobayashi. Hamilton has taken 100% responsibility for that accident, and the stewards didn't penalise either of them, so I'm happy to say that's a racing incident.
You know the biggest shock for me about that incident?
That it was Hamilton again?
No, that's not a shock. The biggest shock for me was Pastor Maldonado being interviewed afterwards,
yeah,
and he put the blame squarely on Lewis. And I didn't, because watching it, I thought it was 50-50. You're looking at the replays, Kamui Kobayashi, he came back quicker than anybody else had done that afternoon. Even though Lewis Hamilton had the DRS and the straight line speed advantage, Kamui didn't give up. He ended up at the point of no return where he couldn't go left because there was a wet, slippery line in the wall. And on his right was a fast-paced Lewis Hamilton, so he had nowhere to go. Hamilton closed the door, but he didn't have to. And so I'd say 50-50. You know, the guy behind has the ability to see more, but if he has no downforce because the car in front's just chopped him, then he can't stop. And I was, okay, 50-50, no decision either way. Lewis comes out, he says it's all his fault, and Pastor Maldonado comes out and blames Lewis entirely.
Yeah, well, Maldonado said, he was talking about the incident in qualifying and said, yesterday we both made mistakes and I'm a bit disappointed that only I got a penalty and not him. Anyway, that's racing and we need to look forward. That's past. The only bad thing is he did the same today. I think he needs to be more focused on his racing and not to do that movement. Getting advice from Pastor Maldonado. Imagine. I'll tell you what is weird is that in all the interviews that I've seen of Hamilton talking about that incident, because he was also on the Jonathan Ross show this weekend, and they played him that incident,
yep,
and asked him a bit about it. He's never said Kobayashi's name. He always says the other guy or that guy or whatever, the other car.
Interesting.
And I just wonder if he can't pronounce it, because, you know, I always get told off for my pronunciation, so maybe he's just trying to avoid criticism like that too.
That Sauber driver.
Yeah, that's the other car.
He did say that. I did watch that. Yeah, and we watched it separately, the ITV thing. We haven't discussed it, actually.
No.
But you're right. I hadn't noticed that. He must have known who it was. Well, he just saw the replay.
But after...
The other guy.
After, well, mid-race, when he was interviewed, because he retired, he also said, whoever it was I was racing. Now, that might be just because he didn't see them.
Yeah, but he just passed the car. Surely you could see it was a Sauber. You're coming up behind. The team would have told him, you're coming up behind Kobayashi.
Yeah.
We should keep an eye on that.
That interview was a bit weird, really.
The one after the accident.
Yeah.
Actually, we should talk about that because I think you have an entirely unique insight into Formula One drivers and what they say and when they say it, because you live transcribed the all of the interviews during the race, as you do for the Fact by Fat Box.
Yeah.
And because you've transcribed Lewis so much, you picked up on the fact that actually what he was saying was complete and utter nonsense.
Well, yeah, I mean, he was talking to Lee or whoever, and the race was still going on. He'd crashed out, and he said, I'm not sure what happened. I just remember sitting in the wall, hit the wall pretty hard, bit unfortunate. We were in a good position. As far as I was concerned, I was ahead of whoever it was I was racing, and then I got hit by them, and then it was over. There have been a lot of races I haven't finished this year, and this is just another one of them. So I typed all that out, and I was thinking, "That I'm a bit worried about him, actually, because none of that is true."
Because the thing is, you could understand if the guy had concussion. It was a fast accident, and you know, if he was winded or whatever in the car, you can imagine he wasn't his, you know, his usual old self.
Yeah, I mean, there haven't been a lot of races that he's not finished. It's his second DNF. Every other race he's been in the points.
Okay,
so it's not exactly a bad season. He couldn't decide if they were in a good position or not. He said they were, then he said they weren't, then he said they were struggling, and he said they could have still got a podium. So he wasn't sure what the performance was like. And he also said, whoever it was I was racing, even though we think he probably should have known who it was. It was a bit odd.
Even though nobody has said from McLaren, and Lewis hasn't said that he had concussion, you do wonder. I mean, you transcribe so much of it. You'd know as well as anybody if he was talking rubbish.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no doctor. I don't know anything. But it just seemed like
an odd... The sentence wasn't sensible.
Yeah, it was an odd paragraph from him. And I just thought perhaps he was a bit shook up.
You have a unique insight into the mindset of a Formula One driver just by transcribing them.
Yeah, he sounded a lot better on the Jonathan Ross show, though, so I think he might be fixed. If you looked at Ferrari's Twitter stream after qualifying, you would have thought they'd had the worst day ever.
Yes.
It was an awful qualifying, according to them.
Even though, where was Massa? Fourth?
Massa got fourth and Alonso got eighth. That sounds all right to me.
It was an awful qualifying for Alonso.
It's not pole position, I'll give you that, but fourth is pretty good.
It was amazing for Massa. Massa did very, very well. Second time this year he's qualified.
Second time in a row.
Goodness me, has gone well for him. Ferrari, as far as I can tell, only think they have one driver.
Yeah.
and honestly to goodness forget that they have Massa at all. And to them, eighth for Alonso was an awful qualifying.
But even that's not awful. It could be a lot worse. Well, it could be Michael Schumacher.
Yeah, but by Ferrari standards, that is awful. I can understand eighth, them being upset about eighth. The problem is they forgot they had a fourth, as you do.
But they didn't do very well all round in the race, really, because it was cold conditions, tyre. They're not good at tyres.
Every single time. Well, they're not good at that particular tyre. When it's cold and when they have to use the harder of the two compounds, they struggle. And again, we saw that. And what they really need is some nice warm races. And this year, it hasn't played into their hands, has it? Because we've had one of the coldest summers I can remember, one of the wettest summers I can remember. And every time it's cold and a bit damp, and the track is a bit green, Ferrari just can't get the tyres to work.
And they don't, I'm not sure there's many races left that are going to be really hot either. Abu Dhabi, I suppose.
It's too late to matter. They're so far behind and the car's so bad it makes no odds. By now, Ferrari must be concentrating on next year's car. They've got to be, because they've got nothing to win this year. Now, how far, I mean, you're ready to hand the title to Vettel. I mean, I was ready to hand it to him in April, but I'm definitely ready to hand it to him now. If I was working at Ferrari, I'd say stuff it. Let's go for next year's car.
If Ferrari think they had a bad weekend, we've got a voicemail from RG, who's pretty sure that Sauber had a worse one.
Is he depressed?
He might be.
Hello, it's RG. Another tough race at Sauber, I guess. But, you know, it was because of some potential, and then we remember that we're a crash-happy team and kicked off again. I'm not entirely sure what's happening with the F1 coverage, because that was just appalling. You didn't have a clue what happened with the Remy, Perez and Kobayashi being in contact. And that really ruined the race. And then, for Perez anyway, and then the contact between Kobayashi and Hamilton ruined Kobe's race. They say that I think it was 100% Hamilton's fault. I might be saying that because I'm a tad biased, just a tad.
I don't remember seeing much of Perez.
Do you remember his drive-through at the beginning?
No.
That scuppered his chances and that was the end of it. First lap, drama, no more really. Nothing
I suppose
to say.
It was
he had a Bruno Senna afternoon.
Yeah, and the rest was dominated by Kobayashi, so.
Well, yeah, we should mention the Kobayashi tank. As bad as RG thinks Sauber is, the car is mighty under attack. Kobayashi bounced off everybody.
At least three incidents.
He touches Lewis Hamilton. Lewis Hamilton ends up in the wall. Kobayashi just sails merrily on round. Mm. Bye-bye. Not a scratch. Kobayashi was already damaged when the two came together. He was already carrying front wing damage when the two cars collided. Still, he carries on. An amazing chassis, that is. It very much is. Not very fast, but very, very strong.
Now it's time for what I like to call race admin, which is all the little bits we do at the end. Starting with...
Catchy.
Yeah, I like that. Oh, you're going to make me a jingle?
No.
Okay.
You might as well call it race misc.
that as well. Starting with Stephen's Paul's performance report.
Diplomatic.
Diplomatic? And why is that, Stephen?
After following the team called him in and he missed the cut, he explained what happened. He didn't have a go at the team. It was very diplomatic, very explained it. Then after the race, when he was asked about Glock crashing into him, all he said was Glock was very ambitious. Pretty good for a rookie to stay that cool and that diplomatic, I thought. A couple of other items. DRS. Although I enjoyed the race, I just thought the DRS made overtaking way too easy. There was a time when overtaking someone outside of F1 was considered impossible. And I can remember an incident years ago where a well-known, experienced driver pulled a young guy aside after he'd tried it and explained, we do not overtake on the outside in F1. Yet on Sunday we saw loads of drivers passing the outside using DRS. Next year they need to deal with that. It may just be that a DRS, along with skinny wings and a long straight from a fast corner, is not a great combination. I'm sure they'll find a way to sort it out, I hope.
I'm not sure why overtaking on the outside is a problem. I think I've missed something here. I really liked DRS at Spa. I thought it was fine. And at Monza, we've got double DRS with two separate DRS zones. I like that the FIA are continuing to tweak it. No one is settling for anything with DRS. It's continually evolving, and I can't wait to see what happens in the next race.
From one rookie to another, Davin has sent us Daniel's Day Out. Peculiar.
No, that's you.
Yeah.
No, you're just overriding Davin. What was the actual word? Play me the voicemail.
No, that is there isn't a voicemail. Davin actually sent me an email.
You're just saying words you like now.
No, shh. It says, hey guys, I haven't been feeling very well, so I don't have the vocals to do the voicemail for Daniel's Day Out. Mm. However, I still wanted to give my input on it, as hey. I have so much fun doing it. Hopefully, Christine can just say the word for me. which I did. And he explains, peculiar, regarding Daniel's retirement from the race. I'm still not exactly sure what happened to him as he just blipped off the radar. Plus, driving an HRT makes it easy for him to just not be mentioned by commentators if he does disappear into retirement.
So you've got diplomatic for Paul de Resta and peculiar for Daniel Ricciardo.
Now we must rate the race, and I'm going to go first. I'm going to give it an 8 because it was good. It wasn't brilliant, but it was okay.
That's very decisive of you. I am only going to rate this race. I'm wavering between... I'm almost thinking an 8 too, but I'm going to go for a 7. And
a round 7?
A pure 7.
Well, I say.
It was a good race. I enjoyed it, but mostly I enjoyed it because of the Fact by Fact box. I didn't enjoy the whole weekend because of the unnecessary controversy, again. And it distracted. I think that took away a lot of Saturday evening was spent discussing that endlessly, you know, the qualifying issues over and over again. I felt drained by the time we got to Sunday of just talking about endless discussions of the same incidents and the same man. And I think for that reason, because of Lewis Hamilton, I'm dropping it a point to 7. Because it just annoys me that he can't be quiet.
Oh dear.
I'd really like it if in Monza he just did nothing out of the ordinary and nothing for us to discuss.
Do you know the hate mail we're going to get?
I genuinely don't care. Even Michael Schumacher wasn't this controversial. Not in one season. And so I'm going to give it a 7 because the controversy dogged the race and it brought it down and I wasn't feeling it. I liked the race. I liked the overtaking. It tailed off towards the end. It was a great start, but the race, it fizzled out when Ferrari couldn't mount a challenge. Lewis was the only guy who was going to be able to take the fight to Red Bull. He was obviously out of contention and there was nothing left for us. Weber was never going to make a fight of it. And that was it, really. It ended maybe 10 laps from the end. That was, you know, that was a good race for me. And then it dragged on a fraction too long.
Yeah. So I'm guessing your driver of the day is not going to be Lewis Hamilton.
Oh my goodness me. No, but you go first, because you rated the race first, and I haven't thought about it.
Yeah, well, I'm in trouble, because I was going to go Michael Schumacher, but now you're telling me that's wrong. So actually,
you can go with Michael Schumacher. It was a good driver. It was, you know, a 20th anniversary. You've discussed in the past how bad anniversaries are, and it was his 20th anniversary for whatever, and he had cake. So that almost guaranteed a bad race.
That's true. Whenever there's cake around, it usually brings bad luck. But if Schumacher's race is a bit controversial, not as controversial as some... perhaps I'll go for Nico Rosberg instead, because at the start, he whooshed past everyone else and got into the lead, which was amazing.
He made a race of it. When the Red Bull drivers were worried about their tyres, they were cautious and they had overinflated tyres for safety reasons. He took his chance and my goodness, didn't he make the most of it. That was fantastic. Really nice to see him leading the first lap.
It was never going to work out. And towards the end, there may have been some team orders going on there.
He took it on the chin. I can't argue with that. I think I could almost go with Nico Rosberg for the driver of the day, but he finished 6th.
Yeah.
Not that impressive a drive. I would like to consult my exclusive SciPodcast race chart, as provided to us by Tony Hurst, a fantastic aid when discussing things like this.
Yes, he does all kinds of amazing visualizations of the data from the race. But this one in particular, I just think is really good because it shows you for each driver where they started, the scope of the positions throughout the race and where they finished. And it just really shows you, like, if a driver started first and ended first, you can see that they're just
a
pinpoint.
That was a quiet race, yes.
If they've got a
summary.
Massive black line like Michael Schumacher would have, it shows that they were quite busy in the race.
If you're into stats, if you're into charts, if you're into data, you must check out Tony's F1 Data Junkie blog. We'll put a link in the show notes on sidepodcast.com. You must check it out. But let me consult my chart of goodness. According to this summary that I'm looking at, Jenson Button is the man who did almost as well as Michael Schumacher. He's the man who made up the most number of places. Dreadful qualifying. And he came through to finish, what did he finish? 3rd place.
He started 13th.
And he finished on the podium, which is amazing. However, there is one man farther down the field, out of the limelight, a man who wouldn't normally get a driver of the day award from me. A man I don't normally rate this guy. But I think Jarno Trulli drove a fantastic race this weekend, because despite complaining all year about a lack of power steering and then being substituted in a race for Karun Chandhok because he didn't like his power steering and then finally getting his hands on,
he was so happy,
some decent power steering, he was over the moon with his power steering in Hungary. He was so happy that he finally got the car that he wanted and he could do something with it, and Team Lotus took it away from him almost immediately. They sent him to Spa without his power steering because it couldn't handle the high loads of the cornering in Spa. And poor Jarno Trulli had to drive that race back with the old car that he hates. Despite having, he had the Nirvana for a period, you know, a brief period, he had that sunshine, he had the car that he wanted, and then they just snatched it back from him. And yet, despite all that, he still managed to finish ahead of his teammate, Heikki Kovalainen, who doesn't have any issues with the power steering. And despite all that, he was still happy. He was overjoyed at the end of the race. He was interviewed by the BBC. He was bouncy and happy and joyous. And you know, the guy had a really good race. And I think that's something to be pleased with.
Where did he finish?
Do you know what? It's probably something like 15th.
Right. So you turned your nose up at my Nico Rosberg because he finished 6th.
Yes.
And you're giving yours to someone who finished down in 15th.
But it was...
I'm just saying.
Fine. Everything was against him at this race. He climbed to the lofty heights of 13th during the race. He qualified 16th. It was behind his teammate, but he still managed to beat him in the end. So for beating Heikki Kovalainen without the brand new power steering and remaining positive, I'm giving my driver of the day to Jarno Trulli.
Feedback.
First up, a message from Chris, who says, "Hi Mrs. Christine and Mr. C, greetings from Massachusetts. I've been a listener for a while but only decided to comment based on one of the topics from your last podcast regarding the pay to watch issue.
Who have I annoyed now?
I completely agree that the British public has been let down on the promise of free to air Formula One coverage made both by Formula One and the BBC. Still, and by no means do I intend to whine here, but you still have the very best and most comprehensive coverage available through both BBC and, coming next year, Sky. Please bear in mind that here in the States our coverage is provided by Speed TV, which is not bad, and Steve Matchett in particular is a highly creditable commentator. However, Speed will often take key members of its team away from F1 to cover car auctions in Las Vegas, which shows the level of seriousness they give our sport. This is in addition to the fact that we have roughly 5 minutes of commercials for every 20 minutes of actual programming, all of which, of course, makes your podcasts all the more important. Only through your broadcasts and the BBC coverage we can download after the fact can we get the full context of the sport. I made the decision to donate the moment I heard Mr. C imply that perhaps paying for Sky might put the Side Podcast business plan out of skew. Likewise, I do not have an iPad, but I'm thinking of buying Mrs. Christine's books for my wife, who does, and if you knew her, you'd understand that is a perfectly appropriate gift. Please keep up the excellent work, and I do hope to run into others of the US Side Podcast commenters the next time we have a gathering here in the Boston area. Be well, Chris."
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for your donation, and I'm sorry that you have to put up with Speed TV. If it helps, it's not going to help, but I'm going to say it anyway. If we had to watch and suffer Speed TV, we wouldn't be doing Side Podcast.
We would have, if we'd started Side Podcast, we would have stopped a long time ago.
Yes, we can only do this with the very best coverage. That's the only way we can exist. And I do feel sorry for anybody with less than excellent coverage. But we absolutely rely on the very best. And we're hypercritical of everything that the BBC do. I mean, everything they do isn't good enough for us because we expect the very best. We need the very best because everything we do relies on the coverage that we're given. And we couldn't do this podcast if we had Speed TV. But thank you very much for the donation.
And I think also whatever they did, we'd want more because we're that kind of person, always
we're quite
pushing
demanding.
Forward. And
yes.
Next up, a message from Jim, aka Ox Wearing Socks, which is a strange
that name doesn't
name.
Ring a bell. And if you know, you'd imagine it would do.
Yeah. "Hey, Christine and Mr. C, just a little email to let you know I've recently begun listening to your podcast and to congratulate you on a job well done. I never email into things like this, but you convinced me to in Christine's Please in Your Nerd podcast."
What did you say?
I don't remember, but whatever I said then, I
say
repeat
it, again.
It now.
Yes. Yeah.
"I did visit the website a couple of years ago and had it on my RSS reader and enjoyed the content back then. I've since gone travelling the world for the last year, in which I managed to incorporate Montreal 2010. Jensen gave me a thumbs up when he saw my Union Jack during the driver's parade, so you have me to thank for his move up to second, as he wanted to impress me, clearly. And found myself some mind-numbing employment to make absolutely no use of my degree. Thankfully, I'm able to use my iPod and have found a love of podcasts. Yes, I'm a few years behind the curve. And audiobooks. Naturally, remembering the quality content from your website, I subscribed to The Real Deal and you've made my days much better. I did have to go through a few on the back catalogue because you very selfishly decided to go on holiday just when I got into your audio charms. How dare you? Don't you know post-gap year graduates need your views? Anyway, I hope you had a good break."
I didn't.
"When things are on the up
no,
and up..."
No, I did have a good break, but I didn't know that.
Yeah.
When
things are on the up and up for me and I'm working on a nice salary and not the current low hourly rate, you can be assured I'll be giving a kind donation for your shows getting me through these long afternoons. I'd love to be an active user in the comments section because it seems a great little community. Perhaps I'll make a few comments when I get the chance, but know that I'm a big fan of everything you've got going on, whether or not I'm commenting. Maybe I'll drop a voicemail sometime. Keep up the great work, Jim." Voicemails to 01212887225.
And whatever you said during the last show, you mean it all again.
Yeah, much more feedback, I think I said. Christine@sidepodcast.com, or you can find the contact form at sidepodcast.com/about. Just a couple more things. A quick shout out to MrSmith125 on Twitter, who said, "My son doesn't like F1, but loves the latest side podcast, so I must be doing something right, and so must they."
I don't know what to make of that, but I like the sound of it.
Well, it depends how old the son is, I think.
Does it? That somebody who doesn't like Formula 1 loves side podcast?
Yeah, I don't know.
It sounds like we've got it very wrong.
If it's a little baby, maybe they just like the sound of our voice.
Okay, maybe you should just keep talking. Even though, you know, we could talk about nothing and, you know, and keep people
entertained. We do that most of the time.
How would they tell the difference? Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Also, Jordan, who often calls into this show, sends voicemails to 01212887225. He actually gave us a shout out on his own show that he was, I think he was filling in for the regular hosts over at Formula Pod.
I know Formula Pod's not a consistent thing with podcasts, so if you guys ever want any podcast to listen to, I would check you guys to go to check out Side Podcast. I know I've already mentioned that with F1 Minute with Christine Blashford and Mr. C. They do F1 debriefs. There's a great group of people there. Stephen Roy, Gavin Brown. I mean, there's tons of them there that you can talk to about Formula 1, and they're very great. So if you guys want to get involved in any other different Formula 1 communities, I would suggest Side Podcast. Probably one of the best ones for you guys to go check out.
Thank you, Jordan. He's super subbing for Formula Pod, who I think we've spoken to in the past. Brett and Corey, I think their names are. They're taking a break from podcasting and Formula One at the moment. I don't blame them. I know exactly how they feel. But thankfully, Jordan's picked up the reins and he's doing a podcast all by his lonesome. So do check that out. FormulaPod.com.
Housekeeping.
It's housekeeping time, which must mean app and book discussion time.
Yeah, I came up with a little ditty.
A what?
Like for an advert or something.
What do you mean?
Well, it goes... If you've got 5 minutes, take a look, then buy the app and buy the book.
One more time?
If you've got 5 minutes, take a look, then buy the app and buy the book.
I'm mildly speechless, actually.
Mortified.
No, that isn't the word. That's interesting.
Maybe I'll make a jingle.
Right, yes. Reviews. That's what I was going to talk to you. We've got some reviews.
I was trying to distract you.
We asked for book reviews, and I know how you hate me reading them out, so I'm going to do that just to make you squirm.
Thanks.
And no more singing, okay? Ian said your book was a modest investment that will provide a great pleasure for F1 fans, young and old. Whilst Jana took a look at the second book, so she's reading it as it happens. Obviously, book two is August and on, and so she's reading that, and she says it's part of a morning routine to wake up and see what the story is for today. So that, you know, she's got that book and she's each and every day she's taking another story from it. And finally from Gavin, he said the book is well researched and the topics are very interesting. He very much enjoyed it. He's also bought book two and he's going to read that shortly. So there you go. You've got three book reviews since our last plea for reviews. So if you've got Christine's book, if you've taken the time to read it, I'd love to hear your feedback on Amazon or on iTunes or in Side Podcast comments, wherever you like to leave your thoughts and feedback. I know that Christine hates me reading these out. She hates compliments, and I love to make her feel awkward.
Thanks for that. You just have to search for, it's called That'll Be the Day, 365 F1 Stories. Search for that on Amazon or on the iTunes iBookstore. And also, don't forget the F1 Minute app, which updates almost every day with the new shows
plenty,
that come out.
Plenty of news
there
since Formula 1 came back. Lots and lots of stories.
Six episodes over the Grand Prix weekend.
There you go. If you've got the app, it's the best way to keep up to date with all of them.
You mentioned Gavin in that excruciating review section. He is planning a meetup in Copenhagen.
That will be a first for Side Podcast.
It will. I think we're calling it Side Podhagen.
Like that. Clever.
Yeah. Pat from the UK is planning to visit Gavin in Denmark over the weekend of the Japanese Grand Prix.
And they want to get together for beers.
Yeah, that's...
I know a man... who likes getting together for beers.
Do you indeed? Is it you?
No. Oh. No, I think maybe we could convince Bassana to go along.
Perhaps.
But yeah, definitely. That's the first a Danish meetup. Never happened before. Be great to if you're in that area, if you're thinking, I wouldn't mind meeting up with Side Podcast folks, but I'm a long way from the UK. I'm a long way from the London meetups. Maybe you can make the trip and see Gavin and Pat.
It's the weekend, the 7th to the 9th of October, and there is a post on Side Podcast, which we will put a link to in the show notes, which you can find at sidepodcast.com.
Grand job. I think that just about wraps up the show, doesn't it? That's Spa.
It does, indeed. Spa a week late.
Well, it's the best way. It's always best to discuss a race when you can't remember a blind thing that happened, I find.
But equally, I can't remember it, but more news comes out and makes a rounder picture of the thing, like the Nick Heidfeld situation.
And
so
the
there are plus
stuff.
And minuses.
Yep. I'm with you all the way. All that remains to be said is we've had a good day. We've seen some action.
Jessica Ennis.
Good night.